I'd like to call the meeting of the House Resources Committee to order on the 14th day of February, Valentine's Day. Today, we have with us Representative Lehman, Vice Chairman Lincoln, Representative Ivan, Representative Harney, and I am Chairman Davidson. For all of you people out there on teleconference, I might add it is a listen-only teleconference, so we can talk to you, but you cannot talk to us. This meeting was called to, generally be a generic overview by the Commissioner or the Department of Fish and Game. And what I would like to do, just so that we're all coming from the same sheet of music, I'll read to you the letter that we did send to the Commissioner in requesting this public hearing. This is addressed to Commissioner Carl Rozier. It reads, "The House Resources Committee will hold a public hearing on Friday, February 14 at 3 p.m. The purpose of the hearing will be to assist committee members in developing a better understanding of the methods and procedures by which the Department of Fish and Game collects, analyzes, and reports its commercial fisheries research data. We would expect you to be prepared to discuss the 1987 tagging study and another research example of your choice, if you wish. I request your attendance and the attendance of Commercial Fisheries Director Dindy Loy, Chief Fisheries Scientist Dr. Eggers, and any other staff you deem appropriate. Please call my office in order that we may jointly develop a clear and useful agenda for the hearing. My staff working on this issue is Jay Nelson. Telephone number is given. With best regards, sincerely, Cliff Davidson." So with that, I would like to begin, but I would indicate that this is not a Board of Fish meeting. We have no desire to do the business of the Board of Fish. This is merely an overview to understand how, in different case studies, information is collected, analyzed, and distributed or given to the Board for them to make their decisions. And so with that, Commissioner Rozier, if you would please join us. And again, welcome to the House Resources Committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to appear here before the House Resources Committee. Before getting started here, I have with me, as requested in the letter, Director Dindy Lloyd, and also Chief Fisheries Scientist for the Division of Commercial Fisheries, Dr. Eggers. I believe that I saw Chuck Beecham, my Deputy Commissioner, come in the door here as well. And, of course, I have Jaron Bruce over here on the right, our legislative liaison person here to help wherever he can along the way here this afternoon. Mr. Chairman, we have a packet of material that we would like to provide each of the committee members with, if that's all right.
Certainly.
Denby, you want to go ahead and pass each of those out? I understand that we're on teleconference here on this, Mr. Chairman, so for the benefit of those people, I'll generally go through what's included in this packet here and let everyone know that generally my charge here is to introduce the subject and give some general introductory comments to the committee, and there will be an overview of the Commercial Fisheries Research Program by Dr. Doug Eggers. And there'll be actions related to conduct and presentation of the 1987 false fast tagging study. This will be Denby Lloyd. And we'll also talk about research enhancements to address complex fisheries issues facing us in various areas of the state here, Mr. Chairman. That'll be covered by Denby and Dr. Eggers on this. To begin with, I'd like to say that the department has got the best professional fishery staff and program in the nation. We take a backseat to no one in terms of the responsibilities for the fisheries resources that we're in fact responsible for here in this state. It's a key industry that provides a tremendous number of jobs and is obviously of great importance to commercial subsistence, recreational users throughout the state. And I don't mean to short anyone there. I think, as I've told this committee before, the Fish and Wildlife Resources are one of the crown jewels of the state. And we take the decision processes, the management processes, and the research responsibilities seriously as far as protection of those resources. I think it's pretty obvious that over the years, the program of the department has been pretty successful. We haven't done it alone. It's been with the support of the legislature. It's been done with the support of the various administrations. But certainly the department has been the front line that has made the decisions on a day-to-day basis that has brought us to where we are today as far as those resources are concerned. When I look back at my career with the department, I started back in 1959, and it was pretty much a disaster around this state in terms of our salmon resources. 1973, when I had moved up through the ranks to the Office of Director of Commercial Fisheries, I believe that our statewide salmon catch at that particular time, or at that particular point in time, was something in the neighborhood of a little over 30 million fish statewide. Through the efforts, as I said before, of the legislature, the department, and a lot of people that were involved in offshore activities, we've been successful in rebuilding that to where, at least in recent years, the last 7 or 8 years anyway, we're doing well over 100 million catch statewide. And certainly from our standpoint, this last year, had we harvested everything that was available, we'd have broke 200 million for the first time in history. That, to me, sir, is a pretty good record as far as the department is concerned in the management of those resources. The research program of the department is one that is consistently under review. It's a program that is consistently in need of new programs and new funding. It's not a situation, it's not a static situation in which we can in fact reach a certain point and we have enough information to in fact provide the management people with the understanding and the basic information on which to make decisions. It's an ongoing process that we have to work at on a continuing basis. As I come back to the department after a number of years away from it, I find that in many cases there's been a lot of advances, but on the other hand, there's still a number of shortfalls in terms of the information that we have to make our decisions on pretty much on a statewide basis. We've got more resources now. Those resources are worth more money now than they were years ago. It becomes more and more critical in terms of making the decisions of how those resources are in fact going to be utilized. Certainly the department and the Board of Fisheries are under an ever-increasing load as far as the management of those resources are concerned. And I think that's what brings us here today, is at least part of the pressures that have been associated with that increasing pressure for making accurate decisions, because they do affect virtually everyone in this state to one degree or another, the decisions made by the department as well as the board. 1987 tagging, I think, is a good example of that. As part of the decision process, it was considered to be the best information available, but it was a situation, at least in my view, where it was a single year's tagging on this, and despite all of the flags that we waved in terms of cautioning people about the interpretation of that 1987 tagging, there's a certain comfort level that people will reach when the scientists put something out with a number on it. It becomes part of the decision process, and at least in my view, you have to heed the cautions that go along with those numbers when they get put out there on the table for the decision process. I think that certainly in dealing with the 87 tagging and putting it forth, I'm confident in my own mind that the department did, in fact, put the cautionary flags out there when the presentations were made. And not in all cases were those cautions necessarily heeded, but I think that we had become comfortable with the numbers to the point that perhaps we were kind of pushing the envelope, so to speak, in terms of how much faith and confidence we could put into that single year of tagging. There was never a question in the department's mind about how sensitive and how important the decisions were that were associated with that one year of tagging. But on the other hand, it was the best information that was available, and we perhaps became a little lax in terms of how we interpreted that and how we applied it. I think in regards to the problems that we've encountered as a result of that tagging, certainly the tagging has been used in a very controversial fishery decision process for a number of years. Certainly from the standpoint of the final report that was in fact submitted on the 1987 tagging, we did find an error. Upon finding that error, of course, we in fact went public with that as soon as it was understood that there was in fact an error, and we had some analysis of exactly what that error meant in that decision process. There was no attempt on the part of the department at any time to cover up, to hide, or withhold information from the board or from the public once we in fact knew what was going on as far as the tagging analysis was concerned. We'll be prepared to talk about that in more detail as we get into this there. But at any rate, once that information was made available, we did in fact make the information available to the decision body, the Board of Fisheries, in terms of their reviewing the situation on the Area M fishery. And I think that the board did that, and as you well know at the present time, the board has agreed to in fact rehear the issue on False Pass and following the March meeting here in Juneau. So the board will be in town to cover that. I think with that bit of overview at this point, I would like to say that I've looked at this issue very closely. There's been a lot of accusations made in regards to both my department as well as the staff in the department. My feeling, my findings on this issue is that those allegations are without merit, and we're certainly here to discuss those issues with you today. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll give the floor over to Denby to proceed with the presentation to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Rozier. Are there any questions that members of the committee would have at this point? Okay, thank you very much. I would like to mention that we have been joined by Representative Mackey and also Senate President Senator Elias. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee, and I'm going to present an overview of the research programs in the Division of Commercial Fisheries.
If you would please, Dr. Eggers, identify yourself for the record.
Certainly. My name is Doug Eggers. I'm Chief Fishery Scientist, Division of Commercial Fisheries. The Division of Commercial Fisheries carries out a large research, or a large program of stock assessment, commercial, and subsistence fisheries monitoring activities. To this end, we implement a large number of data collection projects. Research, as we define it, is considered to be applied research and includes all the activities associated with data collection projects. These activities include project design, project implementation and supervision, reporting, ad hoc data analyses, presentations, reports, etc., that are required by fisheries managers, decision makers, and the regulatory process. In addition, the activities of higher level research personnel, i.e. range 18 and above, include program development, project operational planning, supporting the Board of Fisheries process, and supporting the department's activities in various external regulatory bodies. Because a large number of permanent seasonal positions are involved in data collection activities, roughly 80% of all division's PCNs are involved in the division's, quote, research program. 46% of full-time PCNs are research positions. However, it is difficult to separate the division's budget into research and management because of the joint management and data collection activities of many management and research positions. But at least a majority of the division's budget is funding data collection and app analysis activities. The area research program, I'm going to talk about the area research program, the regional research program, and then the headquarters or chief fishery scientist's office. The area research program, most of the division's data collection programs are operated at the area level. Now, this provides area level integration of data collection with fisheries management activities. This greatly facilitates the real-time consideration of information regarding stock status and fishery performance in management decisions. The area research program includes the seasonal and project leader positions. Project activities are very diverse and include catch monitoring, fish ticket editing and data entry, catch sampling, escapement sampling, conducting surveys for estimated biomass, and we do trawl surveys, herring spawn deposition surveys, crab pot surveys. We also have a large number of salmon enumeration projects, and we use aerial surveys, tower counting, side scan sonar, and weir counting. We also have test fishing projects. Stock identification projects are pretty much routine in all of our sockeye salmon fisheries and also many other fisheries. We use sampling for scale patterns, tissue sampling for genetic markers, we sample for coated wire tags. We also have a lot of tagging and tag recovery operations. Now, the regional research program includes the regional biologist, biometricians, and data processing. These personnel are responsible for developing project operational plans, reviewing and editing project reports, project supervision, and providing technical and biometric and data processing support to project leaders and area staff. These individuals conduct many ad hoc analyses, prepare presentations, support the regulatory process, provide information, and support the Chief Fisheries Scientist's Office external activities. Please note that the regional biologist and regional biometricians have specific program review and report editing responsibilities as identified in policies on operational planning and reporting. And I made available at least copies or excerpts of those policies in your handout. Although the scope and responsibility vary among regions, some regional research personnel actively participate in the Pacific Salmon Commission and the North Pacific Fishery Management Council processes. Most of the external responsibilities associated with the Pacific Salmon Commission fall on research and management personnel in the Southeast region and AYK region. Chief Fishery Scientist Office. The Chief Fishery Scientist is the division's quality control officer, and these duties are accomplished through 1, operational planning process, 2, publications process, 3, developing policies for stock assessment and fisheries monitoring, 4, developing harvest policies that meet biological objectives, and review and approval of various technical personnel matters. In addition to these line responsibilities, the Chief Fishery Scientist Office also conducts generic research, including sonar and technology. There is a sonar technology shop in Anchorage, which provides advice to the regions and also supervise for a short time until these projects are operational. The main river sonar projects in AYK region, including the Yukon River, Kuskokwim River, Noatak, and Kenai River projects. We also do genetic stock identification, hatchery wild stock identification, marine fishery stock assessment methodologies, conduct analyses, and prepare documents and support the public regulatory process of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council and Board of Fisheries. We also serve as departmental chief fishery scientists. The activities of the CFSO, Chief Fishery Scientist Office, as departmental chief fishery scientists include, and these are on external arenas, we have 2 seats on the Scientific and Statistical Committee of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, 3 seats on various North Pacific Fishery Management teams, plan teams, one seat on the Salmon Subcommittee of the International North Pacific Fishery Commission, one seat on the Bering Sea Fishery Advisory Body, and one seat on the Pacific International Council for the Exploration of the Sea. In addition to these formal responsibilities, the CF, the Chief Fishery Scientist Office, has also been the lead technical advisor to the Commissioner and the Governor in their efforts to negotiate several important multinational fishery management regimes in the North Pacific region. These include the Convention for Conservation of Anadromous Stocks of North Pacific Ocean, and this will be effective in 1992 and effectively ends the Japanese high sea salmon fishery. We also, the other one is the International Driftnet Act, and it's effective in the fall of 1992 and ends the squid driftnet fishery. And the third is the Convention for the Conservation and Management of Living Marine Resources in the Central Bering Sea. And this is an effort to establish a multinational management regime for the fisheries in the donut area of the Bering Sea. I'd like to talk a little bit about the division's program and review process. Project development, project review, and project approval is accomplished through the project operational planning process. Project data results analysis are documented through the division's reporting process. The Chief Fishery Scientist Office gives final approval for operational plans and publications of reports. However, most of the work in the review process occurs at the regional level and is coordinated through the Scientific Program Review Committee. And this committee consists of the Chief Fishery Scientist, the Deputy Director for Operations, the Marine Fishery Scientist, the Chief Fishery Scientist Office Program Manager, the four regional biologists, and the four regional biometricians. All projects require an approved project operational plan. The project leader, with assistance from regional biometric staff, developed a project operational plan. The draft plan is reviewed and approved by regional biologists and regional biometricians. The plan is then sent to headquarters. The Chief Fishery Scientist reviews the plan and makes determination if the plan needs further review. If that determination is made, then a reviewer is appointed and assigned to do the review from another region. Otherwise, the plan is approved by the headquarters. Okay. We also have a very formal publication process. We have various types of publications. And as an example of how this review process works, essentially all publications that are published at the headquarters level in our technical fisheries report series or the fishery research bulletin series is assigned a formal peer review, and we assign two reviewers once the report is submitted for publication. And these are blind reviews. The reviewer, the identity of the reviewer, is unknown to the author of the publication. In this way, we maintain confidentiality, which enables the reviewer to be completely open and forward with their reviews without any worry about actions on the part of the reviewer. As an example of how this process, consider a report that was done by Linda Branning, and this publication attempted to estimate the abundance of various stocks of Chinook salmon in the Yukon River based on reconstruction of the run based on an estimate of escapement of one particular stock, the Canadian Chinook stocks, together with information on the composition of the various stocks in the various fisheries in the Yukon River. This is a very important scientific result, and the genesis of that report is that a draft manuscript was submitted to headquarters on June 6, 1988. The draft received three reviews at the regional level and was approved by the regional biologist for submittal to headquarters with a recommendation the paper be published in our fishery research bulletin series. Upon receipt at headquarters, the editor assigned two peer reviewers, and again, note these are blind reviews with the identity of the reviewer unknown to the author of the report. This procedure conforms to standard policy and principles for scientific review of manuscripts for publication, and you can consult the comprehensive publication policy for the American Fishery Society that is given in the handout. The peer reviews were completed by 1 September 1988 and returned to the editor. The peer reviews were then conveyed to the author, and the manuscript was redrafted to address the specific comments of the reviewers. The revised draft was submitted to headquarters on 1st November 1989, a year later. The editor then edited the second draft and returned that manuscript to the author on 6th of December 1989 with approval for publication. Final draft was submitted on 9 July 1990, and the manuscript was published November 1990. Okay, I've provided copies of the division's operational planning policy and the division's reporting policy, which will provide more information for this, our scientific review process. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Eggers. Are there questions by members of the committee? Representative Leland.
Thank you, Chairman. Dr. Eggers, I'm particularly interested in your blind peer review processes. In a scientific community as small as it is in Alaska, I wondered how you maintain that confidentiality when a peer reviewer, like I've done peer reviews of professionals, I will typically when asked to do that, one of the first things I do is call them up and tell them I've been asked to do a review, and then you have that interaction, and sometimes you can take care of a lot of questions just by talking to them. I just wondered, how do you handle that? Obviously, that's not the process you use, and somebody knows this is going on, but how do you maintain that confidentiality and still do a good peer review?
Well, the confidentiality is at the discretion of the reviewer. If the reviewer chooses to reveal his identity to the author, then that's perfectly appropriate. And that's the standard practice in the scientific community,
right,
for its formal scientific publications.
Additional questions? No questions. Representative Lincoln?
Well, Mr. Chairman, to find out the process that we're using here, are we going to then, I'd like to ask Dr. Eggers some questions a little bit later on, but I'd like to first hear the whole presentation.
Yeah, certainly. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Eggers.
Thank you.
I guess next we'll hear from Mr. Loy.
I guess this is on. If the switch is up.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Denby Lloyd. I'm Director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries. And in the packet that we've provided you, there are a number of tabs. Dr. Eggers was referring to tab number 2, I believe, in most of your packets. I would like to present some information that, at least in my packet, is under the first tab. Anyway, it's labeled Milestones Related to the 1987 False Pass Salmon Tagging Study. And there are several pages of this basically timeline that cover history back to 1970 and variety level of detail here. What I'm trying to do is to give you some brief historical perspective, some details that people have more recently made reference to, and certainly a very detailed recent history, because I know that there's some specific concern about when some information has recently become available in relationship to when some decisions have been made. So I'll briefly go down through these. I won't certainly read them all to you, but the issue of the South Peninsula June fishery chum catch, South Peninsula June fishery is often called the False Pass fishery, has been around for quite some time. The average catches of False Pass in the 1970s were less than 300,000 fish. In the mid-70s, the False Pass sockeye allocation, and sockeye is the primary target of that fishery, was established by the Board of Fisheries at 8.3% of the pre-season Bristol Bay sockeye forecast. And that's part of a lot of what you'll be hearing about in this debate is the percentage sockeye allocation for the False Pass fishery and the relationship of the chum salmon cap or restrictions in relation to the sockeye harvest. But most importantly, I think the first 3 years in the 1980s, 80, 81, and 82, were some very large increases in the chum take False Pass. In 1982, there were over 1 million chums taken to False Pass, and that created quite a bit of controversy at that time. Certainly, it led to some proposals to restrict the False Pass fishery out of concern for the natal streams where those chums were going. There wasn't a very clear idea, however, at the time of where indeed those chum salmon originated from. I've illustrated that there had been some early proposals to conduct some stock composition studies of chum harvest there at Falls Pass. There were various review type reports and some initial studies in the 1980s. But perhaps most directly, in 1986, the legislature did specifically fund a tagging study to be conducted on the Falls Pass fishery. And it was conducted on the 1987 fishery, given funding of fiscal years and things like that. That's when the study was supposed to occur, and that's when it did occur. In March of 1988, the initial results of that study were presented to the Board of Fisheries. And also in 1988, we see that the board had, actually in previous years, established a chum cap, but in 1988 they raised what had been a 400,000 cap on Falls Pass chum harvest to 500,000 fish. There are some dates here that illustrate when there was some scientific review of that 1987 tagging study. I also note that in 1990 the board chose to increase the Falls Pass chum cap from 500,000 to 600,000 fish. There's also reference to some other dates of review and publication of the department's chum salmon tagging study. Under the category of recent history, there certainly has been a lot of concern about when, particularly the new corrections to the tagging study were first noted, when they were analyzed, when they presented publicly, and when then the board subsequently took action, which they have done recently, to reconsider their chum cap decision. What I want to illustrate specifically out of this list of dates, and I think a number of you are well aware of this, the initial review that indicated that there was a spreadsheet error in the department's published 1987 tagging study was produced in a memo from a regional biometrician on December 12th last year, and through a variety of transmittals that correction, amongst a variety of other comments, were forwarded to headquarters very quickly. The impact of that correction, however, was not noted in the original memos, and in fact, it would take some analysis time for us to discover that indeed that error would result in an impact to our previous interpretation of the tagging study results. And again, you can see what I tried to list here are what Dr. Eggers was doing at the time, a little bit of what I was doing at the time, some of the other issues and memos that were involved at the time. But we're dealing with the holiday season and the department involved in quite a few activities. The upshot is that by January 16th, Chief Fisheries Science Office was able to concentrate on the issue of the various suggestions by the region. By the 21st of January, Dr. Eggers was able to illustrate not only that the error indeed had occurred, but an analysis of what the resulting impact would be. And that was forwarded through me to the commissioner and from the commissioner to the Board of Fisheries within 3 days. The rest of this listing is a listing of other memos that have gone back and forth in letters, so that people will be well aware of the variety of correspondence that's gone on in this issue lately, and hopefully highlight anything that somebody might have an interest in, and they can certainly receive copies of these from us. I would like to make reference to one letter that we have delivered today to Representative Ivan. He had asked us earlier about the efficacy of either a tagging study or some other method for stock identification of the Falls Pass chum harvest. We have answered his letter, and you also have a copy. I believe you have a copy of it under the third tab, which we'll get to, indicating that we believe genetic stock identification rather than tagging would give us the highest highest likelihood of success of answering some of the detailed questions that the board and the public have about possible stock composition of the false pass catches. Now, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd open up the questions since I really didn't want to read all these dates and titles.
Thank you, Denny. Are there questions or comments by members of the committee or visiting senators and representatives? Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I should probably read the members' correspondence, probably answer it, but Denby, I talked to some people about genetic stock identification, and there's a new procedure, and I lost to come up with what the name is, but it's other than scale sampling that is not, I don't know if it's old with the end of that was talked about the other day, but it, at any rate, it costs quite a bit more money, but apparently you produce results that are substantially more reliable. You know, the downside to us is that it just costs more money. The upside is it will produce better results and probably better management decisions. Has the department made any decisions about what it might promote? I mean, I know we're in a time of declining revenues. It's going to be harder to justify the expense. But on the other hand, we have these conflicts. How do you see it? Or maybe you discuss it here in those memos and I can read about it later.
Well, Mr. Chairman, actually, we do discuss it, but very briefly, Representative Lehman, scale pattern analysis and odorless sampling of things are not considered genetic stock identification. Those are the tools that we have actually used quite a bit in the past. Then there's the tagging method to discern stock composition. But now when we're referring to genetic stock ID, those are, in fact, the more advanced techniques that we are just now getting into and other agencies are also developing. They deal either with gel electrophoretic analysis of certain proteins or indeed some DNA analysis of tissue samples. So these are fairly advanced scientific techniques, and we would propose that rather than scale pattern analysis, rather than a tagging study, that indeed some of these more advanced genetic techniques be used if we're really going to take a good crack at identifying stock composition of false paths. And in our letter to the commissioner's letter to Representative Ivan, we outlined some of that and also some of what we believe would be the associated costs.
Representative Vice Chairman Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following the letter that was submitted that to try and find out how the Department of Fish and Game collects, analyzes, and so forth, all that data, and how that gets to the board, and the information that is disseminated, if you could just back up a bit and Commissioner, I don't know who you would like to answer these questions, but I'll just ask them and you can...
Sure.
...to who. But to get from the initial start of using, as an example, the 87 Tagan study, from when the appropriation was made and the intent of that appropriation by the legislature, I'm just having some difficulty in establishing... all of the documentation that I've been able to read and to put in, and I do appreciate all the information that was submitted to me that I could analyze and put in some kind of a order, that in going through all of it, the original 87 tagging study was to establish the presence or absence of the Western and Interior Alaska chunk in the South Peninsula fishery. That was the intent of the funding. And we moved from that then to expanding that scope of the studies to go beyond the establishment of the presence or absence of that and chum stock. It was very specific to chum. And we moved beyond that to the apportionment of the tagging population and into the sockeye. And I just like to know on what basis then was that decision made? who made the decision, what was the scientific basis in the application of the findings then in relationship to the original intent?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincoln, actually neither Carl or I were in the department at the time, but I'll try to give a brief summation and then ask Dr. Eggers to fill in any details. But you're correct. As I have gone through the record, the initial intent and expectation of the tagging study was that we would tag there and we would find tags elsewhere, and that would give us an indication that fish go elsewhere and maybe what range of areas that they do go to. There was some discussion, however, that given the level of tagging and given some information of the total runs to various areas, that indeed you could garner some more information out of that, not just that they went there, but maybe how many of them went to different places. And that's certainly a lot of the questions that people were asking at the time, and in an effort to try to provide some of that information in a statistically valid form, Dr. Eggers and his co-authors did apply some statistical reasoning to give an estimate of what the apportionment would be. I haven't been able to find a memo that directed, you know, a shift or an expansion of the study, so I cannot tell you offhand exactly at what point that type of determination was made. I don't know, Doug, if you have anything you want to add specifically to that.
Yes, we had.
You can put your chair up there, Doctor.
The process that went on when the department received the funding, we had to do a very extensive planning operation, and this occurred during the spring of 1987. And we had extensive meetings and workshops among the staff, and actually developed a formal plan for the tagging study and analyses. And there's some memos in your package that present a proposal to generate explicit estimates. These are qualified as things we needed to do. A central element of that study was the independent sampling program of the fisheries to recover tags, and we developed that sampling program in the month or two before the season started, and things came together. And we were able to at least do a study that would provide much more information than just a simple presence or absence, as indicated in initial correspondence to the legislature.
Please continue, Vice Chairman Lincoln.
Thank you. Let me try it again. In the original contract that was submitted and the contractor to do the work, it was very specific that it was not on an allocation basis, that it was merely, again, to establish the presence or absence of chum. And I can see where that large quantum leap occurred, but how was the contract, when you talk about the scientific data, how then, when the contract was left to merely look at the presence or absence of chum, and then after the contract was completed, then we went into stock allocation, we went into analyzing the sockeye, that how do you look at that scientifically then, if that was not the initial contract?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I can clear the air on the sockeye. The sockeye were there first, and of course that was the focus of the fishery back in the 70s. The early part of the history of that fishery. You set that aside by saying that the board made the decision in the mid-70s that the RAM fishery would be permitted to intercept up to 8.3% of the season's fisheries. of the, the preseason forecast of Reds. The Reds had nothing to do with the tagging program. It had really nothing to do with the analysis that we're talking about. The program was specific to Chums.
No.
I apologize. Let's
hear from Dr. Eggers.
Again, I was the project grunt. I wasn't the decision maker at that time, so I was in a different position. But anyway, I think the department did have conservation with concerns with respect to chum interceptions at that time. I think there were issues that were raised with respect to the Yukon River. We certainly have conservation concerns with respect to sockeye. We know that the Ugashic stock and the sockeye stock and late running stocks, and there was a certain concern that those might be more vulnerable to the fishery during the later parts of the run. So the tagging study gave us an opportunity to, with essentially no additional cost, to put out sockeye tags and to get information that we needed in a scientific manner to enable us to evaluate some of the conservation concerns that had arisen, together provide the Board of Fisheries with more complete information that they could make the allocation decisions. And we simply just tried to do the best job that we could with the resources that were made available to us.
Are there other questions by members of the committee? Representative Ivor?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make brief comments here. First of all, I have several questions too, and I give the other committee members an opportunity and ask the others as we proceed. I certainly appreciate the comments of Commissioner Rozier when he states that fishery in Alaska is Alaska's crown jewel. And I would add that fisheries has been a life and death situation for Alaska Natives in my area. It continues to provide a primary food item for subsistence and sometimes an only cash resource today for fishermen and women, constituents of mine. My constituents have survived over the centuries and years prior. They've survived a lot of cold environments, famine, sickness, etc. And certainly at this time, beginning in December, my constituents have been going through another agony psychologically and through their mind for the decision that was made with the information that was provided by your department, and have petitioned and used every means possible to try and air out their desires for the Board of Fish to reconsider their last decision based upon recent finding. And with that description of the agony that my people went through, one question that I would have, since the controversial nature and credibility problem surrounding the utilization of the 87 tagging study and the obvious need to raise the confidence level of the public in this process, what does the department plan to do to make sure it doesn't happen again? What do you plan to do to keep this from happening again, and provide the best possible data for the board to make their decision?
Mr. Chairman, I think that in terms of the what do we do from here, I think that we responded to Representative Ivan in the letter and indicate that, as I indicated early on, that really the secret to to making better decisions, whether it's in False Pass or any of the other major fisheries. And this is, there's a lot of intercept fisheries in the state that have got some controversy surrounding them. We've got to go into the, get into the system to collecting information that'll in fact provide definitive information. We're kind of pushing the edge a little bit when we get into some of the data that we have at the present time, that we're being asked to make analyses that really pushes the scientists and the data that's available to manage those fisheries on. And we're just at that point, and as I said in my introductory remarks, we're really looking at situations in which we haven't done a lot of new tagging. We haven't done a lot of new stock ID work within the departments. We're trying to gear up for that, and we need to do that, and that's where we've got to get to. I think that in terms of the comments that we've made to you, Representative Ivan, the GIS system is a step in that direction. This is not going to give you immediate answers. It's a program, it's a longer term program that's going to require gearing up, and it's going to require programs over time to in fact do the stock separation work that's necessary in the individual fisheries to get that information on an accurate basis. Tagging studies are going to be extremely expensive. They get more so every year. Tagging studies have to be conducted over lengthy periods of time in order to reasonably come out of these with definitive information that's really going to give you the basis for some decision making. It's my feeling that that we've got to kind of move into this new technology that Denby mentioned, and we've got to begin to build toward that where we can in fact answer these. What you have as a replacement, until you have that information in hand, is basically the conservative management program. In many cases, you have to take the shot at making the decisions, because the fisheries are ongoing. They don't stop just because you don't have information, but you end up with a conservative management program.
Representative Mackey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to ask a few questions. I just wanted to state the reason that I'm here is obviously the uproar that is taking place in my colleagues' districts out there. I look at that board decision to raise the chum cap as very, very crucial one, not only to the commercial industry in that area, but also to the subsistence and well-being of those people. So obviously I'm very concerned. I think if that situation existed in the district that Senator Eliason and I represent, I would hope that the legislators would be as concerned. I guess I'll get right to the point, Mr. Chairman, if I can. In light of the board making a decision to revisit that chum cap issue, I see the governor has commended the board for doing that in light of new information or perhaps inaccurate information that was provided for their use when that decision was made. Do you intend, in light of the new information, to recommend to the Board of Fish that they revert their decision? I know your role is to advise and provide recommendations to the Board of Fish. Have you made a determination as to whether or not you would recommend to go back on that cap?
Mr. Chairman, I have not made that determination at the present time. Obviously, when we go before the board, certainly there will be some recommendations to the staff, and will certainly be part of the decision process, but that decision has not been made at the present time.
Would you acknowledge, Commissioner, that the information that was utilized to make that decision as being inaccurate? and would warrant further look at and possible reversal of that position?
Certainly, between now and the time that the board meets, we will be reanalyzing the tagging and taking a look, see at what the implications are, and based on, you know, whatever those implications are, then certainly that's what we would base our decision upon. So at this point, I don't know what those are, because, you know, I think we supplied Representative Lincoln with a fair amount of information. There's a number of questions about the tagging that have not been analyzed at this time. So we need to take a look, see at those, and see where we go once that analysis is in fact taking place.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one final comment, if I may, and then I'll be done. I would suggest, Commissioner, that your staff and yourself take a look-see, as you call it, to really take a look at the implications that that decision is having on those people in that region, as Representative Ivan has pointed out. This is not simply a financial fishery decision. It also affects the subsistence and well-being of those people. And I would strongly urge you to consider making a strong recommendation in that regard. I'm certainly not an expert and don't want to advise you how to make a decision, but I know that the integrity of the process needs to be protected, and right now it's being seriously questioned by the people of Alaska. So I appreciate the information that you provided us.
I'd like to go back to the case study here, the tagging study. And if I understand this correctly, that means there were 6,000 chums that were tagged. And we got back 833 tags in the different terminal areas. First, I'd like to know what was the geographic range of those terminal areas? I mean, how many from which geographic range? Did they come from fishermen? Did they come from processors or others? Then I'd like to understand if, in fact, on that amount of return, what did the information tell us about the false pass fishery? And from there, I'd like to understand what it told the scientists and how the information was then taken to the board so that they could make the determinations that they have made on this fishery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to take a shot at answering that question. The study, in a nutshell, we placed a number of tags in the area of the South Peninsula June fishery. We tagged in both the Shingan area and the Unimak area, which are two areas that the fishery is conducted in. And you tried to put in as many.
Would you mind coming up here? And so I think it would be helpful. If,
The Shumigan areas, most of the catches are made off head here in this area, but there are several areas that the seiners operate. And this is a primarily the same fishery. There are a few set nets, but the majority of the catches in the June time period are caught with seiners. The other area of the fishery is in the South Unimak area. Fishery occurs in this area, and it's a combination drift gill net and purse seine fishery.
And those are the two areas where you took the tagging?
Right. We put tags in this area, and we put tags in this area. We tagged both sockeye and chum salmon. And so we were able to get estimates that apply for the Shumigan area and estimates of stock composition. Or basically, we're trying to estimate the origin of these fish that are caught in the fishery. So we get estimates for both the Umac area and for the Shumigan area, and there are significant differences both in the chum estimates and the sockeye estimates in the area.
Now, while you're there, Dr. Eggers, so could you give us an example of the range of where those tags were returned from?
For chum salmon, we received one recovery was in the Queen Charlotte Islands, and then we got recoveries in the Soviet Union. And we got recoveries in the Japanese coastal fisheries, which are Japanese hatchery stocks of chum salmon, which are, I think, in 1987, the fishery in Japan occurs in the fall, in October or November through January, so they're really late-running fish. But the magnitude of catch of Japanese hatchery stocks of chum salmon is order of 50 million.
So how many fish of the 833 that we received back, the tags, that is, are we talking about now? How many these other areas that you just talked about?
These are small. We only got one recovery here.
Only one. Right. And then
I think for the chums, the bulk of the, at least the analysis showed that the majority of the stocks were, for the Unimac area, were Kuskokwim and Bristol Bay chum salmon. The Shumigans were much broader coverage, but the Asian stocks were the most important contributors to the Shumigan area. Again, this is a one-year study, and there's a lot of trouble with tagging. There's some subjective assumptions, and there's probably some uncertainty in the actual magnitude of the estimates, and we try to make that, at least relay that uncertainty to the Board of Fisheries in terms of confidence limits on the estimates. So we presented a range of estimates.
Are there any other areas that tags were sent in from the coastal area of Alaska?
Sure, we got tags in all the fisheries, Cook Inlet, Kodiak, Bristol Bay, Kuskokwim, the Yukon River, Norton Sound.
How many tags were returned from that latter area?
A small number of recoveries were returned in the Yukon and Kuskokwim, Yukon, North Sound, and Kuskokwim areas.
Were they returned by fishermen or processors?
We relied on fishermen to return the tags because the catch is really the largest segment of the population that would be examined for tags. It's very difficult for us to say go in and look at the escapements because you really can't see the fish are very expensive. So the fishery is really the most cost-effective way to recover tags. And so we conducted a very extensive campaign. We had announcements all over the place. All of our emergency orders and all of our terminal fisheries had a statement that the study was ongoing and reminded fishermen to look for tags and to provide them the information to mail them to Juneau. And we had self-addressed stamped envelopes available at all of our area offices, all of our field camps, so forth and so on.
So then we took this information from the tag, and how did you deal with that information? What did that information tell you?
We tried to account for, essentially what we tried to do is account for all the recoveries, all the release population. We tried to account for the ones that ended up in the commercial catch, the ones that ended up in the escapement, the ones that died between the time of release and time of recapture, the tags that weren't reported to us. Generally, in these sorts of tagging studies, fishermen, because it's a bother, it takes some effort on their part to return tags, but you won't get all the tags that are actually caught, so you have to adjust to this underreporting. And again, we attempted to estimate this unreported fraction by sampling, conducting an independent program in the terminal fisheries, where we go out and interview fishermen as they deliver their tags, collect the tags, and then look at the catch directly and see if they got all the tags. And it's very expensive to do this sort of thing, and we were limited by what monies of it were available to the legislature. And I think that's one of the weak components of the study is their sampling program to estimate this reported fraction was really not adequate to do it. And so the estimates are somewhat sensitive to that, and again, we qualified all these estimates with the Board of Fisheries. We had to, in some areas, we didn't conduct these fishery sampling programs. We didn't conduct one in the North Sound area, and the Yukon area was pretty marginal and constituted. But what we did was we assumed the most conservative estimate of reported fraction in our analyses for these areas that we didn't conduct the program. And so, we essentially gave the benefit of doubt to the AYK area where the conservation concerns were, so that if we were going to make an error, we would make an error on the side of conservation and actually overrepresent those stocks in the analysis. And again.
Dr. Eggers, then, comparatively, was this the information that you got on these 833 fish, does this compare favorably with other case studies where you do tagging to try to identify where this stock comes from and where it goes?
Well, this sort of evaluation of the tagging study, I think, has to be done. You have to look at both the results for chum salmon and the results for sockeye salmon. And I don't have the figures, but we know that the distribution of chum salmon in the Gulf of Alaska and North Pacific Ocean is very different. At least the distribution of North American origin chum salmon is very much different, and Asian origin chum salmon is very much different than for sockeye salmon. And I forgot the question.
Well, I was asking about the comparativeness of these different studies.
Sorry. The thing is that the Asian chum salmon are much further to the east in the Gulf of Alaska than our Asian sockeye. So we knew that there was almost no chance there were going to be Asian sockeye in the area of the Unimak and Chumash fishery. And so we essentially had everything covered in terms of looking for recoveries by our sampling programs and fisheries on sockeye in that area. And as such, we had a much higher recovery of sockeye tags than the chum salmon tags, about three times. We got roughly 40% of the tags that we released we actually could account for in the fisheries in Western and Central Alaska. And so the fish that we couldn't account for, we considered mortality. And that mortality rate is 30 to 40%. And it's exactly or very consistent with the mortality rates that we observe in the, there's been substantial tagging of sockeye in this area here, or those in southeastern Alaska, U.S.-Canada treaty negotiations, and the research that went with that. There have been extensive tagging studies of sockeye for a number of years, and the mortality rates are quite comparable to the mortality rates in the UNIMAC tagging study, the 87 tagging study. Now, the chums, on the other hand, we only recovered about 20%, much lower recovery fraction, which indicates that there are stocks that either they higher mortality rate or stocks that we didn't really sample, do a very good job of sampling for recoveries. And the results of the tagging study suggest that the Asian stocks are in the Unimak and Chumash area, and there's a reason for this difference between the sockeye recovery rates and the recovery rates for chum salmon.
Okay, now, after you took that information and you analyzed that, what kind of package did you put it into to carry it to the board?
Well, we presented the results of the tagging study on three separate occasions to the Board of Fisheries, and every time there was it's been an evolution of this study. The first time that I presented it was, I think, in the fall, right after, in 1987. We only had 3 or 4 months to analyze the data, so it was a very preliminary report. And that was presented to the Board of Fisheries, and we had numerous comments. There was news by several scientists on both sides of the question, and these things were considered in redrafting or fine-tuning the analysis. And then the next iteration, I think, was in 88, or we redrafted the report and presented at that time to the Board of Fisheries. I think that's the report that was, the draft was submitted to our departmental fishery search bulletin series. Okay, then at that report, we put it through our peer review process and received comments back, and a year later, I added some things to the report. I added a statistical analysis of confidence limits. I did some sensitivity analyses that tried to look at how sensitive the estimates were for assumptions of expansion factors for the Asian stocks, which we had no information on. These were reasonable guesses, essentially. And I think that made a more credible analysis. And that, at the end of that process, was the final publication, the Fishery Research Bulletin, that was presented to the board at the 1991 meeting.
And now I understand then, from what we've heard stated here today, that that latest analysis now has been found to be in error, or there was a...
Well, if I might elaborate on that, I think the review was initiated because all the questions that had emerged as a result of this study, essentially the presentation of the Board of Fisheries, it was essentially old news. We didn't spend a lot of time on the tagging study at the recent Board of Fisheries meeting because we were preoccupied with a lot. We had coho issues, we had sockeye and north nets, so there's a whole host of issues that we have to get ready for the Board of Fisheries. And the tagging study was really no new information. The Board had seen it before. And so perhaps that was the reason for the we didn't do as thorough a job as we perhaps could have done. And so the Board made their decision. There was a lot of controversy, and the staff, particularly in the AYK region, had to address a lot of questions that came on the tagging study. And so I was involved in meetings and so forth, and they initiated a review of that tagging study. And a lot of them are simply questions asking for our input so that we could address these in an effective manner, since many of the people in the AYK region weren't familiar with the tagging study, didn't completely understand it. So, and then we had discussed, and we're going to prepare, given some time, a set of answers for all these questions. And I didn't get around to that until after the council meeting in Portland. And on January 16th, I began to look at it and notice that there was a mistake. It was a spreadsheet mistake that had propagated through at least two iterations of the report.
Could you expand on the spreadsheet mistake?
Well, there was in the report, generated the estimates using two assumptions. One, using the observed reported fractions, which were those that were enumerated, estimated in these various fishery sampling programs. There was a problem in the analysis, and it didn't have any information to expand to. I had to have some information to base the reported fraction on the Fisheries Division of the Fisheries Sampling Program. And it would be probably more appropriate to use some average and to do that. But there had to be some basis for using the average. And so I went through analysis to see if there were any differences in reported fraction among the fisheries that did the sampling. And it turns out that in the calculations there was a spreadsheet error, and it led me to an erroneous conclusion that I could use the average reported fraction. And in Brummigan's review, he identified that there was a question and a number in this table. And when I looked at it, I realized this was a simple miscalculation. And even though we presented both sets of estimates, I emphasized the estimates using the average reported fraction of the Board of Fisheries. The argument for and basis for that were no longer valid, so we had to redo the estimates using the observed reported fraction. And that was the basis of the revised estimates that were given to the Board of Fisheries in teleconference shortly thereafter.
Oh, I see. And so at this stage, where are we with this reanalysis?
Well, this was one of the problems identified with the tagging study. And so we're going to complete the addressing the questions. I've drafted a version of the response, and that version has been submitted to the AYK region, Central region, and the Western region staff for their comments. And next week I will be taking those and trying to refine the response so they have a unified position. That will be probably presented to the Board of Fishery. There are some other issues with respect to Norton Sound I think we have to take a look at. We'll do that as well.
How common would this error have been? I mean, spreadsheet errors, I know you're dealing with a lot of numbers and a lot of, I guess you're dealing with a lot of things. But when we think of scientific analysis, we, you know, that's, you know, we want to make sure that the integrity of the process is maintained. And could you elaborate on that?
Well, it was an honest mistake. I've made those mistakes before, and that's some of the pitfalls of the modern computation. You get kind of buried in the process, and you can transpose a column or something like that. You work with electronic spreadsheets. It's really easy to do that. I had one column, right? I set up formulas, and I just copied to another column, and it turns out one of the columns was missing. One of the elements of the column was missing in the. Very natural to make those mistakes.
So would better equipment or more assistance or more resources help prevent such errors in the future?
More sleep.
Well, I think review is the best way to guard against that sort of thing. And certainly this study has been in the public dissemination of the tagging study will have benefited from the intense review and scrutiny that's ongoing right now. I think the information and the analysis will be better as you go through that review.
Does this mean then that we would expect other decisions or other tagging studies to come up for review as a result of having found an error in this one?
Mr. Chairman, can I?
Please, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I feel a little bit sorry for Doug because he's in the embarrassing position of having to admit making a mistake when he's our chief fishery scientist. But I appreciate your questions. And I think going back to the previous one, I think additional review and time for review and time for concentration would definitely benefit, you know, the products that we are able to provide to the board and other decision makers. If you look at some of the timelines that I have given to you, which illustrate all the responsibilities that Dr. Eggers by himself has to do within a certain time period, he's racing all over the world, basically. So that is one difficulty we have. We're trying to provide the information. Sometimes the pressure is fairly severe to get it out quickly. On the other hand, it's an honest mistake. People add up a column of figures, and sometimes you add wrong. It's unfortunate. In this case, it went through several years of undetection, but certainly once it was detected and its impact was determined, we did our best to analyze it and present the information. I don't know, your last question was, what was it, I guess? I think it was leading towards what can we do, what further types of things we can do to try to avoid these errors in the future. And I think it comes down to what I just said, more time for review, more time for careful thought and double-checking, triple-checking numbers and things like that. We have the opportunity to do a lot of analyses very quickly with computers, but unfortunately we also have the opportunity to multiply any undetected error very quickly as well.
I can appreciate that, Denby, and certainly I was not trying to pound on you, Dr. Eggers, though. We're in the situation here very similar to that, and more issues, more information, and yet we're expected to do it in a shorter amount of time. So I certainly can appreciate the overload, and I didn't mean to be going after you in that. It just seemed like one question led to another there. And if there's one thing that I would like to see come out of this hearing is if we are in fact going to manage our fisheries, our crown jewels, in a way that befits the crown jewels and makes us survive on those crown jewels, then certainly we're going to have help to people like yourself for more review, for better data collection, for more and improved technology to do the job. And hopefully these are some of the things that will come as a result of this hearing. Representative Lincoln, you have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was allowing time for others to ask questions as well, and perhaps I should have walked it from the beginning again, and since we are And I still have not been satisfied with the process that we take in using the 87 study as a sampling. Perhaps I'll ask the questions from the beginning and then walk our way through this. Perhaps I have been privy to, well, I have been privy to much more information than the rest of the committee members in analyzing all of it and trying to figure out what happened and at what dates and so forth. I still have to come back with, and I hope that you're going to analyze for the board's sake, that what was the intent of the legislative body when that appropriation was made. It was very clear, and I saw no, as I think one of you have said, that there was no one document that said, we are changing the focus of the study. But somewhere along the way, the 1987 study was dramatically changed. And that's an important concern. That should be a concern for any allocation that the legislative body makes and the outcome. Because there are changes in staff, there's changes in this body. So we have to ensure that the integrity of the intent is kept in place. And I would hope that the department looks very closely then at how that study did, where it came that the study took the change. In fact, the study was supposed to be, as I understood through reading all the documentation, and I'm sorry, Dr. Eggers, you were there, so I suppose that a lot of these questions you will have to answer. But the tagging study was supposed to be the first step. Then another study to have the apportion of the false pass fish to the terminal streams. Now, in looking over all of the documentation, I would like to hear from one of you as to when the department at the time gave the contractor notice then to pull back that recovery analysis and to put it within the department. That I'd like to hear a response on that. That actually, that when we talk about scientific and independent analysis, and then the department in 1987 pulls back that portion of the tagging recovery, the final report with reference to tag recoveries, to pull that portion back into the department, then paints the scientific data in the report. And I'd like to hear how that tagging study got pulled back into the department.
Chairman, so there are several questions there. I'm going to take a shot at, with respect to the initial intent of the study, I think, with respect to the initial intent of the study, I think my predecessor, Dr. Phil Mundy, had some serious reservations about what we could do with that study. And so I think in many ways we were essentially, when we agreed to do the money, we weren't sure that we could generate the estimates and do the detailed analyses and results that ended up coming out of the study. And so we were real cautious in what the expectations of the study were at the time that we agreed to initiate the studies. And with respect to the contractor's clear duties were to put the tags out and take care of that. I don't think they had any expertise to do a full-blown analysis of the study at the time. And frankly, the department was very uneasy about having outside contractors make these sorts of estimates when we couldn't really be sure of their expertise. They couldn't conduct the fishery sampling programs and things that we had to use our departmental infrastructure, area offices, and personnel to do.
I would caution you to go back and look at that contract and to see how it is written, because I believe that my interpretation of that contract is tabulate and document data on the tagging of each fish and the recovery of each tag. Communicate the results of the tagging study in a coherent and timely manner. And it goes on. But I just ask that you take a look at that portion of it. And also that when we have an independent study, when we have, I was always told not to assume, because that word can be broken up into some pretty awful terms there, so I never assume anything. That when we look at the whole review process and at how it's analyzed, that I would ask then, did the two co-authors have an opportunity to review the final study and make comments? Or was this sort of piecemealed out, and that there wasn't any one particular, especially the co-authors, to have that opportunity to have a look at that final review?
Mr. Chairman, you're quite correct. Back to the contract, the contractor did have some additional responsibilities besides the deployment tags. They did responsible for much of the publicity campaign, at least getting the letters out and so forth, and they did tabulate the recoveries and construct a database that we used. So there were additional responsibilities. With respect to my co-authors, certainly they reviewed the tagging study, but again, their contributions were fairly specific. It was my responsibility to, because of my expertise, to do the total, the mathematical statistical analyses that were in the tagging study.
I think that also that when you look at the information that has been presented, we talk about the previous error, the computer error, but there were other areas that were pointed out as deficiencies within the study. One, of course, is which the whole intent of the study. But that, and I might have my terminology wrong here, but that those foot observers,
yes.
That the foot observers, that it was poor at best, under the very best of circumstances, those percent, and it came to about 30%, of the foot observers, it was recommended that those not be counted in the overall study because of the conditions that existed. And, well, perhaps you can answer that, and then there were some other observations. So I think it was not the calculation that was observed as being the only area of concern.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it is true that the foot surveys of some of the spawning schemes in Yukon were perhaps not appropriate, but that section of the report was not, those data were not used to derive the estimates of stock composition that were presented in the report. It was merely corroborating evidence, and so that's a clarification of the report that we would address in the redrafting of the report, and certainly we plan to do that, and that was stated in my response to the questions that have been raised in the review. But again, those do not affect the estimates.
Okay.